This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters. Our guest this morning is Patty Goldman of the Seattle Office of the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. She is here to tell us about the status of salmon protection in the Northwest and recent legal rulings that could restrict the ability to protect wild salmon and their habitat under the Endangered Species Act. Welcome, Patty.
Good morning.
Could you start by saying a few words about the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund?
Earth Justice is a nonprofit organization that's been around now for almost 30 years, and we were established to provide legal services to other organizations and sometimes individuals when they need to go to court to protect the environment and natural resources. We're a nonprofit. We provide legal services free of charge, and the goal is to protect the environment.
Could you now tell us about your Fish, Trees, and Water campaign?
The Seattle office has a campaign called Fish, Trees, Water, which is designed primarily to protect wild fish, salmon, steelhead, bull trout, and the focus is on protecting the habitat that these fish need to survive, hence the Fish, Trees, Water. The fish need trees, they need water. We're focusing on water quality, on habitat, and all the various pressures on wild salmon in our region.
What is the status of the wild salmon stocks here in the Northwest currently?
Unfortunately, salmon have undergone a great decline. Depending on the stock, they are now at somewhere around 10% or less of their historic numbers. For some salmon along the Columbia River, for example, there are hydropower facilities, the dams that block passage and have incredible mortalities for the runs. There's habitat destruction from logging practices, from agricultural practices and urban development. Basically, we have changed their habitat. They are under decline. We have over 24 listings under the Endangered Species Act of salmon and steelhead, and it's starting to turn things around, so there are greater protections now for the habitat and the salmon.
On September 10th, 2001, a ruling was made in Oregon that coho salmon born and raised in hatcheries must be included with a wild coho when considering listing under the Endangered Species Act. What is the history behind this ruling?
Well, it was an odd case in a way. It began because there is a hatchery on the Alsea River that was doing very poorly. It was not even producing returns equivalent to the numbers of salmon that were put out in the stream. The salmon had been raised in captivity for so long, they were very different from the wild runs, and it was losing a lot of money. So the state of Oregon decided to close the hatchery. And as that was happening, the salmon would come back to the hatchery, and a videotape was taken by an individual showing the salmon being clubbed and the salmon being sliced open for the eggs being saved and the salmon being thrown in another pile to either be given to food banks or put into the rivers, and they became outraged. And what's odd about that is that's what hatcheries do. Hatcheries get the salmon when they come back. They club them over the head, which is one of the more humane ways to kill salmon, and take the eggs and the sperm and mix them to create eggs that are raised in captivity. The difference in this instance is that the salmon eggs and the salmon carcasses would be used for food but not for procreation. They were no longer going to produce eggs in the hatchery because they decided to close it. And as a result of the outrage over this incident, lawsuits were brought to try to keep the hatchery open, but it was far too late for that since the decision had been made years earlier. Then lawsuits were brought to try to keep the Oregon officials from killing the fish, which is odd given that that's what you do. And eventually it turned into the case that was decided in September, which is whether the listing had to be changed and accommodate hatchery fish in a different way than the original listings. And that was the ruling in the case. It's actually a very narrow legal ruling in the case, but with great repercussions around the region.
What do you feel is wrong with hatchery fish being included with wild fish in determining whether the Oregon Coast coho salmon need to be listed?
Well, the ruling was that the government had lumped the hatchery and wild fish together in the unit it had identified for listing. Once it had done that, the court said the government had to look at the entire unit, listed on an all-or-nothing basis. It's kind of an odd ruling because hatchery and wild fish play different roles in both sustaining salmon and in the environment. Hatchery fish are not self-sustaining. they exist because of a factory-type facility and the aid of human beings. And that's how we get the kind of record runs that we had this last year, because we can produce fish, we can put them into the rivers, and then we get fish back. But it does not mean that those fish can sustain themselves without that intervention. Wild salmon, on the other hand, for thousands of years have been able to sustain themselves and to adapt to their environment so that they can withstand natural disasters and changes and basically sustain themselves over time. That's a big difference. So if you're talking about a listing under the Endangered Species Act, the question is whether these fish can survive in the wild, in their natural environments. And that question's answered very differently depending on whether you're looking at wild salmon, which are sustaining themselves in the wild, or hatchery salmon, which are sustained by human beings in concrete pools.
How different are the hatchery and the wild salmon?
Well, it depends. We have different kinds of histories throughout the entire region. In the Oregon coast, the hatcheries have been there for a very long time to compensate for overfishing and habitat destruction. Their purpose is to produce fish for harvest. They have never tried to be managed for recovery. And so the fish are produced, and they are often produced in ways that change their behaviors. For example, one very measurable change is that the return times of the salmon has been moved up a couple of months. And that happened because the hatcheries want to take the eggs early in the season and raise them in captivity and let them be bigger when they're released. The more time that the hatchery has, the more the juveniles can grow. So they're bigger when they're released to go to the sea, and they can outcompete their wild cousins. They have a greater survival rate then. But that is, while it helps success in the hatchery, it actually impedes the survival of the fish in the wild, because they return earlier, they're more susceptible to fall floods. So that change in behavior, which is very real, has hurt the fish in terms of their ability to sustain themselves in the wild. Another very interesting difference is in reproductive capacity. The hatchery salmon do not have as great a success rate when they do stray from the hatchery and try to reproduce in the wild. They exhibit poorer courting behaviors. When they do actually spawn, the eggs don't survive at the same rate. It's about half the rate of the wild salmon. And even when there are eggs that are produced that do hatch, the return rates are far inferior. More wild salmon will return per spawning adult than hatchery salmon. So often the hatchery fish do not even reproduce themselves in terms of the numbers of returning fish. That has implications in the long run for sustainability.
How widespread are the hatcheries here in the Northwest?
Well, again, that varies by stock. I can tell you for the Oregon coast, there are 13 hatcheries that were included in the listing unit. There were a couple of others that were very different from the wild stocks. In Puget Sound, there are about 36 hatcheries. So there's quite a significant hatchery presence. For a couple of stocks, there are no hatcheries in the area. So it varies a great deal. Puget Sound is definitely one of the more heavily dependent on hatcheries.
Now let's go on and talk about the implications of the delisting of the Oregon coho salmon that took place last September.
Well, it has implications because the government used the same exact approach in addressing all of the hatchery fish throughout the region. There are 26 listings. Two of them do not have affected hatchery stocks, but the other 24 would be vulnerable. Now, the endangered listings are actually not vulnerable under the ruling because all of the hatchery stocks are listed when the fish are listed as endangered. That means they're in more dire straits. But for the threatened listings, some of the hatchery fish were listed if they were needed for recovery. Some were not. And that's what the court said the government cannot do. It cannot pick and choose and decide which ones are needed for recovery or are operated in that way. It must list all of the hatcheries along with the wild fish or none of the fish at all.
And what are the ways that this is going to directly affect wild salmon recovery?
Well, what we have now is several processes going on which will help answer that question. It's kind of an intermediate step. The first is the case is not over. The government decided not to appeal, but environmental and fishing groups represented by Earth Justice intervened in the case to basically do the government's business and to appeal that ruling. That appeal is underway. The Court of Appeals issued what's called a stay of the district court decision, which means it will not have any effect until the appeal is over and the Court of Appeals has weighed in on this issue. So the appeal will decide whether this is the rule of law that will apply to the listings and whether they do need to be redone. And that will play itself out over the next year. The other venue is the government itself. Instead of appealing, the government decided to conduct a review of both how hatcheries are addressed and the listings themselves. So it will have a two-part review. The first part is deciding what its hatchery treatment should be, and it will do that through a public notice and comment and public hearing process that should start in a month or two and go through next fall. Once it has decided how it will treat hatcheries in its endangered species listings and for recovery, it will then apply that new policy to the two dozen listings that are affected. And it may just leave all the listings in place, which is what we think the outcome will be, or it may propose to delist some of the stocks.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Patty Goldman of Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. Our topic is salmon protection in the Northwest. So what are some of the activities that would be allowed if the delisting were allowed to stand that would harm salmon?
If salmon are delisted, then there will not be the same protections against changing habitat in ways that cause injuries to salmon. And that could be logging that causes landslides or silts up the rivers, or agricultural activities that put pesticides right in the rivers, or roads or dams or urban development projects that block fish passage. All of those kinds of activities are constrained under the Endangered Species Act. They also may be constrained under other laws as well, but that's the impact of an endangered species listing.
In terms of groups that are fighting for different sides of the ruling, you mentioned the environmental groups, of course, are on one side, but who then is on the other side of this issue?
Well, we represent not only environmental groups, but also commercial and sports fishing interests. And there's a huge interest on the part of commercial fishing families in recovery of wild salmon so that they can have the kind of way of life they used to have, a sustainable way of life. And in sports fishing interests, there are tremendous industries that have developed over sports fishing, and again, they need wild fish to be able to sustain those enterprises. On the other side, there is a case pending in Washington, D.C., that attacks some of the Chinook listings, including Puget Sound Chinook. And the entity that has brought that case is illustrative. It calls itself Common Sense for Salmon Recovery, and it is a coalition of sorts that includes the agricultural interests in the form of the Farm Bureau and like groups, urban development interests in the form of the home builders, grazing interests, logging interests, and fairly conservative political figures such as former Senator Slade Gordon, Representative Doc Hastings are listed in their membership group. And they are the spearheading the attack on the Chinook listings. The interests tend to be those that don't want restrictions on activities that do harm salmon.
Do the hatchery fish themselves deserve protection?
That's an interesting question. The government has often looked at whether the fish that remain are wild in their origins or pure hatchery fish in their origins, and has decided in the past that it cannot protect pure hatchery fish under the Endangered Species Act, that it needs some wild genesis for the species, which is one of the reasons the appeal may prove to be successful, because it raises a fundamental question of what the Endangered Species Act is there to protect. Is it there to protect the wild species or species that have been changed because of captive breeding and zoos and that sort of thing? I think we have often put it, do we want lions on the Serengeti or lions in the zoos? It's a fundamental question that this case raises.
And how do you think it'll be decided?
Well, I think it is very clear that the Endangered Species Act is about protecting God's creatures in their natural environments. It's about not just the fish themselves, but their habitat, which means you've got to look beyond what people can do through zoos, through factory-like facilities. Let me give an example that I think helps highlight this kind of contrast. Let's say we have fish farms that can produce fish that live their entire lives in captivity, and we can produce them in large numbers from the eggs that we take from the wild, and then we just keep producing them. Is that good enough that we can have fish farms and not have wild salmon? And the difference between fish farms and hatcheries is the saltwater cycle. The entire freshwater life cycle of hatcheries is spent in captivity. Then they're introduced into the rivers to return. But does that mean we shouldn't protect the purely wild fish because we can produce our own fish as well and then have them share those rivers for part of their lives?
And how is the government arguing on this point?
Well, the government is basically an empty chair in court now. They did not appeal. They did not fight in the courts to keep the listings in place during the process that's happening now. That was left to the environmental and fishing groups. It's kind of a sad state of our policies these days that the Bush administration is choosing not to defend the protections we have in place for salmon and other species and public lands, and it's left to private citizens to do the government's work. On this, I think they are very confused about what the position will be. The science is clear that there are some very real differences between hatchery and wild fish, and that if we want to protect wild fish, we need to focus on wild fish. Hatcheries can have their place. They can produce fish for harvest, but that doesn't mean that they eliminate the need to protect habitat for wild fish.
Focusing now on just the wild fish themselves, could you explore a little bit what in the Endangered Species Act allows for a given population of salmon to be protected, even though in another area salmon may be thriving quite well?
Yeah, the Act protects species and subspecies, and then there's another term that's used that is called distinct population segment. That is not a term of art or science, but it was a concept that was added to allow protection of a population, even if that same species may be thriving in another country or another part of this country. So, and there's a wonderful example in the Act when there was a proposed definition of species that would include animals that could interbreed and produce fertile offspring. And a very angry Representative Dingell gave this example of buffalo that were very endangered, but who shared the same range with cows. And they can interbreed and produce fertile offspring. And he expressed his outrage that we could have an act that would not protect the buffalo just because they could interbreed with the cows. And that was the genesis of allowing there to be other kinds of non-species-based descriptions of what populations would be protected so that we could protect them based on their plight. If they need protection, if their habitat's declining, their numbers are down, we can protect them even if the species definitions might treat them differently.
Could you expand on the plans of your office to follow up on this Oregon Coho ruling and exactly how you plan to follow it through to the end of the process?
Well, we've learned our lesson that as these cases are brought to challenge the listings, we need to intervene to defend. We are moving to intervene to defend in the case on the Chinook, the Puget Sound Chinook, and three other Chinook stocks. The Pacific Legal Foundation, a conservative legal group, has threatened to file a case involving the Northern California, Southern Oregon Coho, focusing on the Klamath. They've threatened to file that next week. We will be there to defend that listing. So that's the first step. We'll be there in court. Longer term, we're there on the appeal, and in the administrative process, the government will be reviewing its policies on hatcheries and listings. It's important to be involved in that process to show support for protecting wild fish. And what we've done is basically look at the statute and look at the legal options. The only legal option at the end of the day, even after this review, is to still give endangered species protection to wild fish. The wild salmon need protection. No matter how the hatchery fish are counted, the wild fish need the protection of the Act.
Could you tell us about some of the other legal cases that are being brought here in the Northwest to protect salmon?
Yes, there are cases that are underway on the Columbia River hydropower system to ensure that that system is operated in a way that will allow salmon migration around the dams and most likely will require changes in that system. There are also cases involving forestry activities, both on the national forest lands, the public lands, where logging is underway that is often harming salmon habitat. For the federal lands, there's a plan in place, the plan that was put in place as a result of the Northern Spotted Owl litigation. It has great potential to protect salmon as well if it's implemented in that way. We've been involved in litigation for 4 years trying to strengthen those salmon protections so that the logging can go forward in ways that won't harm salmon. And then the focus has shifted now with the listings to some private activities, private forestry activities, to make sure that the logging that's done on private lands isn't causing landslides or isn't so close to the streams that it's denuding the riparian corridors and we can still have shade and cool, clean water for salmon to spawn. So we're looking now, there isn't as much litigation, but some on pesticides and its use and impacts on salmon, some urban development projects, so that it's not just the forest lands, but the other parts of the habitat that are needed.
Could you expand on how you feel about the government's role in all of these issues?
Well, what we have a governmental system that changes with elections. Over the previous 5 years, even starting probably 10 years ago, we slowly put into place the building blocks for a salmon protection scheme through the region that was starting to change a lot of practices. Some were changing slowly, some of it was painfully, but it was clear that we needed to make some changes in behavior so that we could continue the activities in the region, but also have wild salmon and clear, cool streams and good water and all of those things. Now what we're finding is a shift, and we're finding a lot of lawsuits being brought by interests that don't want to be regulated, that don't want to change their behaviors, and we're finding a receptive administration. So the defense is not always there. And we are at a point where we risk a lot of backsliding in terms of the protections we have in place, and there are, I think, incentives that are being eliminated for people to change their behaviors. So right now, I'd say we're in a very precarious place. The laws are still there. They still require these protections. So I think it's a painful backsliding that we will overcome and we'll get back to the place that we were at and still look forward. But we're in an unstable time right at the present time.
What do you think the best thing that citizens can do is to help protect salmon at this point in time?
I think it's important to still voice support for protecting wild salmon, and that there will be opportunities in this public hearing process that the government will have. This will be the National Marine Fisheries Service that will be conducting this review of its hatcheries.
How soon will that be taking place?
They have said they'll have a proposed policy by the end of February, but it looks like there may be some sliding in that date so that it may happen later in the spring.
And some of the hearings will be here in Seattle?
Yes, and there'll be an opportunity for written public comment as well. That will all be announced publicly when they release their policy. And I think it will be a very public kind of hearing process so that people have an opportunity to become involved. There will also be an opportunity to supply information to the government about the particular listings, since the government will be reviewing each of the listings, and they're going to be asking for any information that people have about the different salmon stocks and whether they need to be listed. That's a very scientific-based determination. And then I think it's important for individuals to look at their own activities and do what they can to make sure that we're not polluting the water and degrading the habitat, and just voice support for what we can do in this region to make the kind of healthy streams that salmon need.
Looking at other regions of the country, are there similar types of suits going on in those regions that are analogous to the ones going on in the Northwest in regard to salmon?
There are definitely a tax on the listings, or one part of counterpart of the listing is the designation of critical habitat for the species, which generally affects what the federal government needs to do to protect that habitat. It doesn't affect private lands, but there are industry lawsuits throughout the country attacking those designations of critical habitat. There are attacks on environmental regulations, both under the Endangered Species Act and otherwise, seeking more economic analysis of the impacts and trying to basically sue under some of the Contract with America reforms that were put in place by Newt Gingrich. Some of those are now finding their ways into the court in a big way. What that means is that people want an opportunity to show the economic impact, hoping that that would get rid of some regulation that would have an economic impact, regardless of the need. And we're starting to see more and more of those kinds of cases.
How optimistic are you that the Endangered Species Act will actually remain intact through our current political climate?
I'm very optimistic. The American public overwhelmingly support that kind of a protection. And when the Newt Gingrich Congress and others have decided to mount a wholesale attack on the act, they have been stopped in their boots. They have not proceeded because of popular opposition, and it's way too controversial to take that act on head on. Instead, what we see every year when budget bills are being passed is riders that are tacked onto those bills that will prevent the act from applying to the Klamath Basin, for example, or will decide that listings should not be funded. So that no more listing decisions will be made, or that there was one that we called the Extinction Rider that would have given Gail Norton the right to decide whether to act on any petitions to provide endangered species protections to species. That was defeated. So there are often riders, which are more your surreptitious device to try to restrict the application of the act in certain situations. We'll see those, I'm sure, every year.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think we can do it. I think we can protect salmon. We can have salmon in this region along with a successful economy. And I wish that the entities that are trying to destroy the whole system and get out of it would instead put their resources into trying to make it work and to make the changes that could be made. They don't need to hire lawyers to try to throw a bomb on the system. Instead, they could hire people that could devise the solutions that we need.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Patty Goldman of the Seattle Office of the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. For more information, check on the web at www.earthjustice.org. Again, that's www.earthjustice.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week.